Welcome to Native America Calling. I'm Sean Spruce. Keeping up with all the vaccinations that public health experts recommend for children takes dedication, and Native American parents are lagging behind their counterparts elsewhere. There are a number of factors for that, and we'll discuss those this hour. We'll also look at how the vast amount of information about immunizations from a variety of sources can muddy the water for those wanting information about the safety of vaccines. We'll start that discussion right after the news.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. In Canada, the government of Prime Minister Justin Trudeau has unveiled its budget for the year with nearly $53 billion in new federal spending. But as Dan Karpinchuk reports, First Nations leaders say the omission of reconciliation in the budget speech was alarming.
After criticizing this year's budget, many First Nations leaders are looking for a renewed commitment from the Trudeau government. They say Finance Minister Chrystia Freeland failed to talk about reconciliation in her budget speech. Among those who are looking for more is Newfoundland Regional Chief Brendan Mitchell. He was expecting to see what he calls a reconciliation budget.
We're not seeing a lot of positive change. And the change we need with respect to housing and infrastructure in this country on behalf of Indigenous people and communities requires a faster pace of action.
Also disappointed, Grand Chief Kathy Merrick of the Assembly of Manitoba Chiefs.
And yesterday, Canadians heard how the federal government plans to spend resources for the coming months and years. Yet this process is marred by a glaring omission. And I was there yesterday to be able to hear, and I did not hear any words pertaining to reconciliation, unfortunately.
But others were less critical. The Métis National Council praised the financial blueprint, calling it a step in the right direction. And there was new cash for Indigenous peoples, $9 billion, to cover major issues such as child and family services, education, health, housing, and on-reserve income assistance. And ministers in charge of Indigenous affairs say reconciliation has not dropped in priority, calling $9 billion a big investment. But in the 2021 budget, $18 billion were earmarked for Indigenous communities. For National Native News, I'm Dan Karpinchuk.
A Wisconsin tribe is one of the first tribal nations to sue social media companies. As Danielle Kading reports, it's one of two tribes accusing companies of contributing to higher suicide rates among Native American youth in a recent lawsuit.
The Menominee Indian Tribe and Spirit Lake Tribe in North Dakota filed the suit against companies that own Facebook, TikTok, and YouTube. They're demanding companies take responsibility for dangerous features that lead to compulsive social media use. Mary Owen is director of the Center of American Indian and Minority Health in Duluth. Owen says anything that's harmful to teens will be felt even more by Native American youth.
These social platforms, media platforms, are harmful to everyone in that they're not about community. They're about an individual. But they're even that much more harmful to a vulnerable population like Native people.
The lawsuit notes American Indians in Wisconsin were hospitalized for self-harm at more than double the rate of white residents in 2022. A Google spokesperson says the tribe's claims simply aren't true. Researchers say media effects vary widely among individuals, posing both positive and negative outcomes. While there's evidence of harmful practices by companies, they say a direct link between social media use and suicidal ideation is lacking. For National Native News, I'm Danielle Kading.
The United Nations Permanent Forum on Indigenous Issues began this week in New York. The session is covering a number of issues, including the environment, culture, education, health, and human rights. Leaders are also focusing on the UN Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples. The theme of the session includes a focus on Indigenous youth voices to highlight their role and values in Indigenous communities. A 10-year milestone is being marked this year, the adoption of the World Conference on Indigenous Peoples. It will be commemorated Thursday with an event hosted by the President of the UN General Assembly. The UN Permanent Forum on Indigenous Issues runs through April 26th. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
National Native News is produced by Kawanak Broadcast Corporation with funding by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
Support by the Gathering of Nations Powwow, a live event taking place April 25th, 26th, and 27th on the powwow grounds of Expo New Mexico, featuring song, dance, traders market, horse parade, and more. Tickets available at gatheringofnations.com and at the gates.
Support by Drummond Woodsum, a full-service law firm whose nationally recognized tribal nations practice provides services to tribal nations and their enterprises and to companies that do business with tribes across the country. More at dwmlaw.com.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Network.
This is Native America Calling. I'm Sean Spruce. Immunizations protect children from more than a dozen life-threatening diseases, including polio, pertussis, diphtheria, and mumps. The shots are routine, and children who attend daycare or school are required to have them. But numerous studies find Native Americans have among the lowest immunization rates. The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention cites poverty, lack of health insurance, and long distances to health providers as barriers for Native Americans. On top of that, confusion about the safety of vaccines creates additional hesitation for parents. The CDC documents an uptick in measles cases in recent years, mostly due to reduced vaccination rates. We'll talk with doctors this hour about infant and child immunizations. As always, we encourage listeners to call in with your comments and questions. Do you have easy access to all the vaccinations your child needs where you live? Do you have questions about any specific vaccines? Call us at 1-800-996-2848. And a disclaimer, today's show is informational and educational. You're welcome to ask our guests questions about vaccines, but if you have serious concerns about vaccinations for yourself or your child, please consult directly with your doctor or healthcare provider. Let's now meet our guests. Joining us in Phoenix, Arizona, where he is attending a conference, is Dr. Matthew Clark. He is the Chief Medical Officer for the Alaska Area Native Health Service and Chair of the Indian Health Service National Pharmacy and Therapeutics Committee. Good morning, Dr. Clark. Thanks for joining us again on NAC.
Hi, good morning. Thank you for having me.
In Bethel, Alaska, we're joined by Dr. Ellen Hodges. She is the medical director at Yukon Kuskokwim Health Corporation. Dr. Hodges, good morning to you too.
Good morning, and thanks for having us on.
And joining us from Meadow Lakes, Alaska, is Ashley Bethel. She's the Alaska Native Tribal Health Consortium Immunization Coordinator. Good morning, Ashley, and welcome to you too.
Hi, good morning. Thanks so much for having me.
Absolutely. It's a pleasure to have you all on our show today. Dr. Clark, let's begin with you, and let's talk a little bit about young children, infants specifically. At what age are they able to be safely immunized?
So I appreciate the question. Really, the immunization recommendations for infants begins at birth with vaccination for hepatitis B, and then a series of vaccine visits follows thereafter at 2, 4, and 6 months of age, and then again at a year of age for infants.
So that first vaccine they get, that's for the Hep B. What's that called?
So the hepatitis B vaccination, it's actually a series of three vaccines that are administered over the first several months. And there are a variety of different versions of that, but that's the first vaccine that's typically provided, usually before discharge from the nursery in the hospital.
Okay, thanks for that clarification. And then after those first three series of immunizations, what comes next?
So then beginning at 2 months of life, there are a variety of other vaccines that are recommended. So these include the rotavirus vaccine, which is designed to protect against viral infection that can cause gastrointestinal illness, the diphtheria, tetanus, and pertussis vaccine, a vaccine against a bacteria called Haemophilus influenza type B, and then a vaccine against a group of strains of a bacteria called the pneumococcal conjugate vaccine. And then finally, At that two-month visit, the first dose of a three-dose series also included is an inactivated poliovirus vaccine.
Okay, so help me out here. How many vaccines did you just list there at 2 months?
So it's a total of six vaccines. However, those vaccines are oftentimes given in combination, what's called a multivalent vaccine, to minimize the number of actual injections.
Okay. And what about for measles? Is there a vaccine for measles now?
There is, yes, and it's existed for quite some time now. So the MMR vaccine, measles, mumps, and rubella, is typically given somewhere between 12 and 15 months of age, and then a booster dose usually given between 4 and 6 years of age. Oftentimes for folks who did not receive that booster dose, an adolescent dose is also recommended.
Okay, now I know right now there is a trend for measles. What's causing that?
Well, one of the problems is the declining rates of vaccination across the country, including, you know, really all racial and ethnic groups. This was made worse by the COVID pandemic, which affected access to routine vaccination. And so when vaccine coverage rates drop below a certain level, that increases the likelihood that a virus like measles can spread within communities. And then we're also seeing some introduction of measles from other countries as well.
So there was so much focus on getting people vaccinated from COVID. Some of these other vaccinations just kind of fell off the radar. Is that what happened, Dr. Clark?
Not so much the focus on getting people vaccinated for COVID, although that may have been a smaller factor. I think it has more to do with, during the pandemic, people were not seeking routine care in the same way that they were would typically seek routine care. So, you know, in an effort to reduce the spread of COVID, a lot of services went into the virtual realm in terms of telehealth. And then there were folks who, for various reasons, were not participating in routine preventive care visits. So in that way, you know, obviously it takes an in-person face-to-face visit to administer a vaccine. And that way there were some impacts on access to routine vaccination.
Now, currently in the United States, Dr. Clark, are vaccinations absolutely required in every state for kids that attend school or daycare, or is there some flexibility there, and do some states have some different policies?
So typically, states do require a routine vaccination for school participation. However, there are exceptions, and those vary state to state.
And for folks that are interested in getting exemptions, I mean, what are some of the primary motivators for a person to say, I don't want my child to have a vaccination? What's their thought? What's their opinion on that?
Well, you know, the main issue would be if someone had an allergy to a component of a vaccine, that would be a reason not to receive that vaccine. What it can tell you is that vaccines as a whole go through an extensive vetting process. And the vaccines that are currently recommended for infants and children, and for that matter, adolescents and adults and older folks, have all gone through that extensive vetting process and have all been found to be extremely safe and effective. And so, you know, it's really important that we listen to parents' concerns and caregivers' concerns and try and address those concerns and meet people where they're at. But ultimately, we would like to promote routine vaccination as a safe and effective way to reduce the risk of complications from vaccine-preventable diseases.
Now, when the COVID-19 vaccinations came out, there were some pretty vociferous debates regarding the importance of getting those vaccinations. And there were some folks that just said, hey, you know, I don't want to get the vaccine. I'm not confident. I'm not trusting it, that it's safe. They felt that it was, you know, rushed too early to the market and things like that. Do you see any of those same attitudes with regard to children being vaccinated, and specifically Native children? Do you meet people that say, hey, I don't feel comfortable having my child vaccinated. I don't want them to have some of these vaccinations, especially at such a young age. And if so, how do you approach that?
Sure. It's a great question. So first of all, I want to point out that for a substantial period of time during the COVID vaccine campaign, American Indian and Alaska Native people across the age spectrum had not only the highest rate of COVID vaccination compared to any other racial or ethnic group, but it was the highest by far. And, I really give the credit for that to tribal leadership, tribal communities, and getting the word out and talking about the importance of protecting tribal communities from COVID. And I think the same is true for routine vaccinations, including for children and really across the age spectrum. I think working together with tribal communities, with tribal leadership, with tribal health and public health staff, reaching out to trusted messengers in tribal communities and getting the word out about the safety and effectiveness of these vaccines, it's a really important way for us to promote vaccination in tribal communities.
Now, as a child advances in age, you mentioned these early vaccinations, these six specific vaccinations in infancy. What are some other vaccinations that kids need as they progress up to becoming teens?
So one thing I want to point out is that in addition to the vaccines, the routine vaccines that I just mentioned, we also talk about the respiratory viral vaccines that are seasonal typically. So this does include infants typically beginning at 6 months of age. So that includes RSV now with newer vaccinations that came online last year for our 2023-2024 RSV season. Of course, it includes seasonal influenza, and it also includes the COVID-19 vaccine, which is proven safe and effective as young as 6 months of age. For older children and for adolescents and adults, there are also recommended vaccines. We mentioned already the measles, mumps, and rubella vaccine, but there's also the varicella vaccine, typically given to children in their second year of life, as well as the hepatitis A vaccine. As kids mature into adolescence, there oftentimes are booster doses recommended for vaccines to protect against tetanus, diphtheria, and pertussis, and then also the introduction of the human papillomavirus, which is the only vaccine that's ever been proven to protect against certain types of cancers.
All right, we're going to take a short break. We'll be back with Dr. Clark and our other guests. Stay with us, listeners.
The racially charged murder of three men set off months of protest, conflict, and reflection in a city bordering the Navajo Nation 50 years ago. We'll hear about what's been dubbed the Choke Cherry Massacre and what has changed and what hasn't in Farmington, New Mexico since then. That's on the next Native America Calling.
This program is supported by AmeriCorps Vista. You can kickstart your career by joining thousands of AmeriCorps members in the VISTA program serving to alleviate poverty. AmeriCorps members help organizations make change right in their own community. A service opportunity that fits your ambition can be found at AmeriCorps.gov/VISTA today. That's AmeriCorps.gov/VISTA.
You're listening to Native America Calling. We are focusing on immunizations today. Vaccines prevent once deadly diseases like polio and smallpox. Parents, do you keep up to date with your child's immunization records? Let us know by calling 1-800-996-2848. That's also 1-800-99-NATIVE. Our next guest, Ellen Hodges, joins us from Bethel, Alaska, where she's the medical director at Yukon Kuskokwim Health Corporation. Dr. Hodges, we learned from Dr. Clark the importance of getting these vaccinations for infants and newborns. And what barriers do you find there in your area in Alaska with regard to child immunizations?
Sure. So some of the barriers we experience, we're in a very remote and rural area, so getting vaccines out into our villages safely, because there's temperature regulation on how the vaccines have to be kept at a certain temperature. They can't get too hot or too cold. And so it's important to make sure the transport of the vaccine is good, or the children and their parents need to come in to Bethel. So our region has no road, so people come by airplane to our hub here in Bethel to get vaccines. So sometimes the weather is a big factor in getting these kids vaccinated. So those are some of the things that are unique to our region that can occur here. But I mean, there are, and the same things that Dr. Clark pointed out for all the other types of things that can come up with people.
Now, Dr. Clark also mentioned the RSV vaccine, and you just wrapped up a program that distributes the vaccine. Tell us more about it.
Sure. So RSV, or respiratory syncytial virus, is a common respiratory virus that in older children and healthy adults causes a mild cold. But in newborns and young children and in elders, it can cause a very serious infection. The area that I live in, the Yukon-Kuskokwim Health Corporation area, has the worst RSV in the world, but certainly in the United States. And as a result, we have many children who become infected with this as a young child, and this can affect them throughout their whole life, causing chronic lung disease. So this year, we were very lucky to have an antibody, an RSV antibody, given to newborns and young children under the age of 19 months to help prevent serious RSV infection, and then also a vaccine that can be given to pregnant women and also elders that helps prevent RSV in them. And then pregnant women, they can pass on those antibodies to their baby before they're even born and protect those babies. So the antibody is called nirsevimab, and we were able to have a distribution program out to our villages to vaccinate our young children out here. And it was a very successful program. We were able to offer vaccine through partnerships with the Indian Health Service, Dr. Clark's folks, and as well as the state of Alaska to provide the nirsevimab, which was on a nationwide shortage, to our region to vaccinate the kids in our region. And overall, it was a very big success, and we're very pleased with how that program went.
Now, I understand people are often concerned about side effects from the RSV vaccine. What are the side effects?
Sure. So the one that was given to infants is actually an antibody. It's not the vaccine itself. It's the actual antibodies against RSV. And we have always had an antibody that was available for RSV, but prior to this last fall, it was only for medically fragile children. So think of your children that are premature or might have chronic heart disease and things like that. But the nice thing about nirsevimab is that it was all children were eligible for it. So kids can get injection site soreness, so a little bit of redness and soreness at the site of the injection site. And these are young children, so we can't really ask them, but I suspect they could probably get some muscle aches and pains in the first day or two. But other than that, this vaccine, or it's rather an antibody, was very well tolerated.
And Dr. Hodges, I mean, I have a daughter, she's 10 years old, and I remember when she was an infant and all those shots. And sometimes I think those shots, maybe they hurt the parents more than the babies, just to watch your kid get stuck like that. How do you help parents and grandparents and whoever else is in that room with their child when they have to go through? Because it's painful.
Oh, it is. It is. And it's painful for us, too, as providers who are doing it. During our vaccine rollout, where we were going out to villages offering this nirsevimab, we also offered everyone to update their kids if they hadn't been updated. You know, it's hard to get their kids in, and as the previous difficulties I discussed getting vaccines out to villages, some of the kids had fallen behind. And so some of these kids were getting quite a few injections. And the thing that helps with it is that, like, a minute or two after these vaccines are administered, and I'm sure Dr. Clark has seen this too, they're up and running around the waiting room. You know, we let them wait to see if there's been a reaction for a few minutes after the vaccines, and they're running around and they're happy and cheerful. And I think just seeing that can help the parents feel relief about that. But especially for the brand new newborns, it's hard to see them suffer or get an injection like that. And so I often talk about the protection that this offers to them, and the, you know, a lot of people out here know families that have had, or they themselves have had, infants with RSV, and they know the suffering that the parents and the families go through with that. And so talking a little bit about how, you know, an injection to prevent that sort of suffering, even though the child suffers for that few seconds while they're getting the vaccine, is important as well. And then offering the child some comfort measures while the vaccine is being given. So if they're breastfed, often asking the mom to breastfeed during that time period or offering a distraction during that time period also can help with everyone's comfort level.
Now, how many tribes and villages are in the area that you serve, Dr. Hodges?
Sure. We have 56 tribes in 46 villages.
So that's a big, big service area. About how many square miles?
I'm not sure about the square miles, but it is about the size of the state of Oregon.
And that's got to present even more challenges than sometimes just that geographical area there, so much space, so many miles to cover. What are some additional issues that you have to deal with just being that spread out?
Well, probably the biggest thing, so I was joking with our public health people, why can't we have a vaccine distribution in the summer when the weather's good and it's easy to fly? Because, you know, of course, we were distributing this in October and November where we have winter and the flights can be delayed or even canceled because of bad weather. And so you're sitting, you know, waiting with your vaccine bags ready to go out to the villages. And it can be frustrating because you know you have life-saving vaccine and you know that you have parents and children waiting for you on the other end, but it's hard to get there because of the weather. And, you know, you have to think of safety first with aviation in Alaska. So that was one of the bigger things is, you know, getting all packed up and ready to go and up at the airport with all of our vaccine ready to go, but then having the flights be canceled or delayed because of bad weather. So I think that really, especially since, you know, it's fall and winter often when we're going out with these big vaccine drives, especially for these respiratory-specific vaccines. So I think that's one of the bigger things that comes up. And then I mentioned before, the temperature, it's cold in Alaska in the winter, and you have to make sure that especially the nirsevimab doesn't freeze, and it also can't warm up. So we have specialized bags that can maintain a good temperature actually for days if you're careful. And so just making sure everything's packed correctly by our public health colleagues and our colleagues that work in our immunization department, just to make sure that there's, you know, a constant temperature so that you don't get it too hot or too cold.
And some of these vaccines, I'm interested in the costs. Are some of them more expensive than others?
Yes, absolutely. There are some more expensive than others. But the wonderful thing about the state of Alaska and our population with Indian Health Service is there's a Vaccines for Children program that provides these free of cost. So there's no cost to our infants and families that need these life-saving vaccines.
All right. Dr. Hodges, I'm also interested in, you know, what was the impact of these diseases on these communities before these vaccines were developed? And just how big a game changer is it that these vaccines are available in communities as far away as remote parts of Alaska?
Oh, yeah, that's an excellent question. So I'm going to talk a little bit about Haemophilus influenza type B that Dr. Clark mentioned we now vaccinate children against. This was a devastating disease in our region. Many children got severe meningitis from this infection. Some died. Many were severely affected with lifelong developmental delay, hearing loss, and brain injury. And it's so rare now to see this disease that since I've been out here for about 21 years, I've only seen a handful of cases, and prior to my arrival and prior to the introduction of this vaccine, it was a relatively common thing to see. And so to see that be nearly eradicated has been just an utter blessing. And RSV, I hope, is going to go the same way. I think any one of us who's sat at the bedside of a small infant struggling to breathe can only think that nirsevimab is a miracle for this population. And during this last respiratory season, we had about an 87% vaccine efficacy with our nirsevimab, meaning hardly any of the children that were hospitalized for RSV had gotten nirsevimab. So for the children whose parents were able to, you know, give their kid this vaccine, it was a game changer. And some of the statistics that our Department of Public Health here at YK has been able to compile is that you were 8 times more likely to seek medical attention for a respiratory illness and to test positive for RSV if you did not receive nirsevimab. So not only did it prevent hospitalizations, it prevented those doctor visits and health aid visits in the meantime for respiratory illness. So I sincerely hope as the years pass, we can talk about RSV as a thing of the past.
Yeah, I do too, certainly. Dr. Hodges, thank you for joining our show. And let's move on. I've got another guest who I want to introduce here in Meadow Lakes, Alaska, Ashley Bethel. And Ashley, thank you again for joining our show. And let's talk a little bit more about vaccine hesitancy. And what are some comments you might make to a person, say, who doesn't want to get their child immunized? Maybe it's because of they're concerned about maybe it's a religious issue, or maybe they're concerned about their child, you know, not being able, maybe having a reaction or something like that. What do you talk to them about?
Thank you. That's a great question. I'm glad to share about how our program approaches vaccine hesitancy. We're facilitating vaccines and immunizations in more of a public health presence, and we work to educate and train both providers and patients that are curious about vaccines or seeking vaccines. You know, one of the most important things when you're speaking with someone who's having some hesitancies about vaccines is to just make sure that they feel heard and that they're comfortable asking questions and seeking answers to some of the things that they're worrying about. Because if we're not giving people an opportunity to ask the questions, our doctors and healthcare providers aren't given the opportunity to give the answers and spread the messages that vaccines are safe and effective.
Now, earlier I talked about those debates over the COVID-19 vaccine, its safety, its effectiveness, and you know, how people might think about vaccines in general. And are there any efforts to maybe clear up some of this misinformation or just make some of these details more available? Because it seems like there's still a lot of people out there that just are scratching their heads on some of these issues.
Yeah, absolutely. We do focus on eliminating misinformation and disinformation when we're coordinating our social media campaigns or our vaccine messaging. It's definitely a focus. And you know, we're working with state partners and regional partners to include messaging that's relevant to their communities. And we're also working to deliver activities or events, community outreach that will benefit the communities that we serve by providing just the opportunity to clear the air, to sort of, you know, give people an opportunity to talk about the misinformation they've heard and then to have it addressed. And we're also working hard just to sort of connect people again post-pandemic. I think that all of us can agree that, you know, the COVID-19 pandemic really divided people in a way that we hadn't really seen before, and that the conversation around vaccines has become a little bit more tense. My program is working with other programs, behavioral health professionals, and Native Alaska artists to deliver events where, you know, people can bring away sort of multiple items of value that are important to them. You know, we bring a Yupik and Yupik artist, a mask carver. His name is Drew Michael. He and our team travel to different communities, and he shares his art and he discusses the history of these cultural art pieces and how, you know, historically they played an important role in the health of the people. And so we also give those participants an opportunity to create a piece of art. So these people are able to design and create a mask. And then we have a talking circle that's led by culture bearers and elders and some behavioral support professionals. And people really are able to share their experience of the lockdown, their experience with questioning the COVID-19 vaccine, their experience of feeling isolated or separated from their loved ones. And then after the group shares their masks, Drew Michael, he curates a 3x4 mask that is just stunning and is returned to the community to do what would be appropriate to that community, whether it be a cultural celebration or some ceremony. But it's really special, and we've heard so much positive feedback about the event and how it's contributing to increased conversations about COVID-19 vaccines and vaccines in general.
Now, cultural approaches like you describe, Ashley, those always really resonate with our listeners. And you mentioned Drew Michael, and we actually have Drew Michael on the line right now. Drew, hello.
How's it going?
I'm doing great, Drew. Now, as Ashley describes, you use masks to help educate Alaska Natives about COVID vaccine and other vaccines. What got you involved sharing your artistic skills with getting folks vaccinated up in Alaska?
Well, thanks for having me. I love bringing masks. They're all about transformation. So when you think of somebody putting a mask on, they become that identity. And there's a transformation that happens within, like, telling a story, right? So when people in a community are able to create a mask and put kind of a picture to their emotions or thoughts, they're able to describe their emotions a lot more and their experience. And so it's like a way to allow people to have the freedom to tell a story. And I'm very interested in the healing aspect of masks, to like think about how everything carries energy and how things pick up that energy. There's spirits in the world, and we want to honor those things or share that story. So when people are able to come together and tell their story, there's a release.
All right, we're going to take another short break here. We come back more with Ashley Bethel and Drew Michael here on Native America Calling. Sure would like to get some calls going, especially folks up in Alaska. 1-800-99-NATIVE.
Support for this program provided by the American Indian Higher Education Consortium, the collective spirit and unifying voice of 35 tribal colleges and universities. For over 45 years, AHEC has worked to ensure that tribal sovereignty is recognized and respected, and that tribal colleges and universities are included in this nation's higher education system. Information on a tribal college or university near you at AIHEC.org.
This is Native America Calling. I'm Sean Spruce, and we are talking with medical professionals today about the importance of immunizations. These shots are common and required by law in most public settings, but Native Americans are a population in this country that often has harder access to immunizations. Do you or did you ever struggle to have a child or a grandchild vaccinated? Let us know at 1-800-996-2848. The number again to our Albuquerque studio, 1-800-996-2848. One of our guests on the line today, Drew Michael, is a carver. He is a carver in Alaska, and he helps with outreach for immunization efforts. And Drew, before break, you described that wearing a mask sometimes allows a person the freedom to tell a story, that masks have healing aspects associated with them. Can you describe for our listeners some of these masks that you've carved for these events, what they look like?
Yeah, well, so every person, when they come to the our gathering, they're able to kind of paint an image of their own story through the pandemic and their experience with COVID, if they had it. And then afterward, we're able to share, everybody shares in the talking circle their story, and there's not any feedback except for thanks for sharing. So everybody has the chance to freely share their story. And then I take all of these stories and the pictures of the masks that everybody has created who have come to the event, and I create a community representational mask to gift to the community to kind of represent their story as a community through COVID. So every single community is different. And when you look at the mask that represent the community, you can feel the whole place. It's amazing.
It sounds amazing, Drew. Really, really inspirational. Let's go to the phones now. Our first caller of the day, Derek, listening in White Mountain, Arizona, on station KNNB. Hello, Derek, and thank you for calling in today.
Hi, good morning. So I just wanted to mention a few things about the contributions of Indian country to the whole conversation. I used to work, I'm a member of my tribe's health board. And so we have White Mountain Apache tribe has been fortunate to have a lasting relationship with Johns Hopkins University. And so a lot of the immunizations that have been discussed so far have been studied in various phases of the clinical trial here in White Mountain and across Navajo Nation. And so I know Indian country is contributing to that global discussion. And then more recently, a lot of people have participated in the COVID-19 vaccine study. I was part of that study. I served as an EOC for my tribe in response to COVID-19. And so part of my responsibility, I thought, was to be a part of the clinical trial and show people that, hey, you know, it is safe and it is working, and it's, please take advantage of the vaccine.
Derek, what was that experience like participating in that trial? I'm interested in learning more about that.
Yeah, and so as I mentioned, I serve on my tribe's Emergency Operations Center for COVID-19. And so seeing firsthand the devastation that the virus had in my community, you know, I felt like maybe there has to be more I can do. And so when Johns Hopkins Center for Indigenous Health said, you know, hey, we're recruiting participants for the COVID-19 vaccine, I signed up without hesitation. I consented, and then I got the shots. And I just felt like, you know, I had to be a part of the solution on a local level, but then it has global implications.
Well, Derek, really appreciate you calling in today from White Mountain, Arizona. First call of the day. And we've got plenty of time. If anybody else would like to share their comments on the air, 1-800-99-NATIVE. I want to go back to Dr. Ellen Hodges. And Dr. Hodges, we hear from our caller about the importance of tribes contributing to vaccine development. And do you work with any other tribal communities that have done any kind of vaccine development like what Derek describes?
Oh, absolutely. And actually, we also work with Johns Hopkins and the White Mountain Apache as well with numerous trials. A couple of examples, of course, was the hepatitis B, which was trialed on Alaska Native individuals in the 1980s. So we have kids that were vaccinated at birth and, you know, born from the 1980s. And they were just out doing their 40-year follow-up for some of those kids, which was very exciting. I mean, and obviously they're not kids now, but so that was very exciting. When the pneumococcal vaccine came out, we participated in a compassionate use study to get more the vaccine available for our children earlier, because of course pneumococcal vaccine severely affects our population as well. So our population has worked closely as well with multiple different types of vaccine trials. The Haemophilus influenza B vaccine is another example of a vaccine that we worked with the companies to get it out here earlier under the compassionate use kind of study protocol. And I think that's a good example of the contributions, like Derek was saying, of the Alaska Native people to the information available now to everyone in the world for vaccines.
Right. Now, I would imagine perhaps that recruiting folks to participate in a study like that might present some challenges. It seems like maybe people would be concerned about a risk of, you know, like being a guinea pig in a sense. How do you approach that when it comes to bringing people in to participate?
Oh, yeah, that's an excellent question. We have a fantastic research department here at YKHC that trains very well working with vulnerable populations and the Indigenous communities as well. We have councils of elders who advise us. We have councils of patients who advise us. And I think one of the most wonderful things about working the population I've been blessed to serve in these past few years is the willingness to contribute to a community. And that, I think, protecting children, protecting elders, and protecting the community against a disease is important to the indigenous populations in our, in probably in all regions, but especially in our region. And I think that helps as well. I can't emphasize enough how caring and loving the population is. A good example is this RSV vaccine, right? So we can vaccinate elders and we can vaccinate pregnant women and we can give antibodies to children. And people want to get the vaccines to protect themselves, yes, but also to protect the grandchildren in their home, if that makes sense. So I have found in this population that that willingness to not only contribute to, you know, scientific development, but also to protect and hold their communities dear.
All right. Thank you. Thank you, Dr. Hodges. Ashley, where can our listeners go to learn more about the Alaska Native Tribal Health Consortium and your outreach events?
Yeah, they can visit anthc.com/immunizations, or it would be best to email us directly at immunizations@anthc.org. Our staff is eager and excited to spread this project as far and wide as we possibly can, and also be of service to our regions and our regional tribal health facilities to support their efforts in any way possible with, you know, our other educational opportunities and resources. So yeah, email immunizations@anthc.org.
All right. And Ashley, when they attend the next vaccination outreach event, what are the chances that they'll be able to meet Drew in person?
I'd say 100%. We won't run the activity without Drew. He's integral to the project's success. And, you know, it's really important to have him be central to the messaging as well.
All right. Drew, it sounds like you're a pretty popular guy up there at these events. How does that make you feel?
Oh, I love it. I love bringing people together and helping people find a space to heal and to think about how we connect to the world. So it's a beautiful experience. It's good. We're releasing something that we've been holding on to for so long. And that's what I'm all about, like helping people get to that space.
Now, have you done carving or other types of art-related projects for other healthcare programs?
Yeah, actually, I worked with my friend Elizabeth Ellis, and we did a show called Aggravated Organisms, where we had 10 large masks that connected to 10 different diseases, and we traveled those. They were huge, 3x4, 3x5 foot. And we traveled them around the state of Alaska and then also to Seattle, and we were able to share these images of what these diseases do to our bodies, how they impact our bodies. And we gave people the opportunity to sign the backs if they had been affected. And in the end, as Yupik people, we see that everything carries energy. So what we wanted to do was allow that to be released in a kind of a traditional healing way. And we transformed those masks in a fire ceremony and released it. So we kind of let go of all of the trauma of all of the things that have impacted us as people. Mm.
Right on, Drew. Really appreciate you joining our show and sharing your wisdom and your expertise. I want to go back to Dr. Matthew Clark. And Dr. Clark, we have a lot of listeners on our show from all over the country, and we might have somebody right now listening to this show, and they're thinking, geez, you know, it's been a while since I looked into the immunization records for my child or for my grandchild or even for myself. Where can a person find out that information, their own vaccine status?
I think that's a great question. So what I would recommend for anyone who has questions about not only their vaccination status, but also vaccines that are currently recommended for them, they should consult with their primary care provider and with their healthcare team. I want to point out the IHS in November of 2022 rolled out our E3 vaccine strategy, which we seek to offer every patient at every encounter, every recommended vaccine when appropriate. So really our goal is to promote vaccine coverage rates that are high in Indian country to help protect tribal communities from vaccine preventable illnesses. If I may, Sean, I do also want to brag a little bit on my colleague, Dr. Hodges and her team at YKHC. She talked about the effectiveness of the nirsevimab during this last RSV season. So nirsevimab, that long-acting monoclonal antibody that's recommended as an immunization for infants beginning at birth and for American Indian Alaska Native infants all the way through 19 months of age during the RSV season, which is typically in the fall through the spring. But I want to brag a little bit on Dr. Hodges and her team at YKHC. That effectiveness really has to be looked at through the lens of the work that they did. You know, our travel partners there did a fantastic job using innovative strategies to promote access to that immunization during this last season. And I understand from Dr. Hodges that maternal vaccination rates approached 100% in the YK region. And they also had very, very high rates of vaccination among eligible infants and toddlers with nirsevimab. So really wanted to give kudos to her and her team. And I think it really demonstrates how innovative strategies in tribal communities, particularly promoted by tribal health organizations and tribes, can be very effective.
All right. Thank you, Dr. Clark. Dr. Hodges, lots of compliments coming your way. And I also want to ask you, Dr. Hodges, I mean, we're talking about these diseases here, polio, diphtheria, mumps, but are there any other diseases that there aren't vaccines now that could be real game changers if vaccines were developed for the next few years? And if so, what are those diseases that we're also still worried about in our communities, our native communities?
Yeah, that's an excellent question. And we talked a little bit about Haemophilus influenza type B. So my goal would be to have a Haemophilus influenza type A vaccine. We found that when we vaccinated children against the type B, type A started to increase in frequency in our population and also causes devastation. So I would like to see a development. And I know there's some work, especially with the First Nations in Canada, who are also deeply affected by type A Haemophilus influenza. I would love to see a vaccine against that particular disease. And I think before this last fall, I would have said RSV, and I just can't even emphasize how pleased I am to have a vaccine against RSV, which is one of the leading causes of hospitalizations and deaths in children in our region.
All right. Thank you. Dr. Clark, any dream vaccines that you can think of right now with regard to current illnesses or diseases?
Dream vaccines? You know, I think one that has been in development for a long time, but which we'd like to see is a vaccine to prevent HIV infection. But that said, I really want to circle back to these new RSV immunizations for not only for elders, but for pregnant women and for infants and toddlers. As Dr. Hodges referred to earlier, I think that's really going to be a game changer. You know, we had some supply chain disruptions in the first season for the nirsevimab. IHS was able to work with the manufacturer to supplement the vaccines for children supply to ensure that there was adequate nirsevimab to distribute across Indian country. And I think that moving into the next RSV season, those supply chain issues should be less of an issue. And we're really hoping to promote widespread vaccination and immunization with RSV products. And that's something that we have available to us now.
All right. Thank you, Dr. Clark. And we're going to have to wrap up the show here, folks. We are just about out of time. I do want to let everyone know, though, that next week is National Infant Immunization Week. So maybe record that in your calendar there on your smartphone or with the calendar that's on your wall, whatever works for you. And with that, let's give a big thank you to our guests who joined us today, Dr. Ellen Hodges, Dr. Matthew Clark, Ashley Bethel, and artist Drew Michael. Wonderful conversation here about the importance of immunization and its impact on Native communities, especially up there in Alaska. Please join us here again tomorrow. We'll be taking a look back at the Farmington, New Mexico Navajo protest that started after the April 1974 murders of three Navajo men by white high school students. I'm Sean Spruce.
Support from Dartmouth College, hosting its first Tribal Leadership Academy August 4th to the 10th in New Hampshire. Up to 25 new or appointed tribal government leaders and a group of experienced presenters will consider intergovernmental relations, economic development,
healthcare, natural resources, and tribal law and order. Dartmouth College will cover the travel and attendance costs. Application available at DartmouthTribalLeadershipAcademy.com. Application deadline is May 1st, 2024.
April is National Alcohol Awareness Month. Join a support group to help yourself. If you have Medicaid or are insured through the marketplace, you may qualify for treatment options. For more information, contact your Indian healthcare provider or visit healthcare.gov or call 1-800-318-2596. A message from the Center for Medicare and Medicaid Services.
Oh, hetsa te welo.
Native America Calling is produced in the Annenberg National Native Voice Studios in Albuquerque, New Mexico, by Kwanic Broadcast Corporation, a Native nonprofit media organization. Funding is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, with support from the Public Radio Satellite Service. Music is by Brent Michael Davids. Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Network.